I think we're all set now. So, show of hands, who's got their Christmas tree up already? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah, me too. A lot of you. Not everybody, but most of you, it looks like. Okay. Keep your hands up if you had them up by last Sunday. A few hands went down. Okay. Okay. Keep them up if you had them up by Friday after Thanksgiving. Oh, am I the only one, really? That's the day we put ours up. That's like the tradition. We don't go out shopping on Black Friday. We put our tree up on Black Friday. That's as soon as Thanksgiving is over, it's the time to move into Christmas. I was going to try to catch whoever put it up before Thanksgiving and call y'all heretics. That's what I was going to do. But nobody did it. All right. Okay. Well, some folks do like to celebrate Christmas as early as possible. And that's okay with me as long as the Christmas music, which I love, doesn't start playing before Halloween. Okay? That's like there's a cutoff. All right? And there's no doubt that now as we move in, we've passed Thanksgiving and we're into December now, that we have absolutely entered the time of the Christmas season. And one of the challenges for followers of Jesus in this time and in our culture today is how to keep our mindset and our attention focused on the real meaning of this amazing season. And so in order to help us focus on that, on Christ this morning and in the season, instead of the massive amounts of commercialization. Do you see what I did there? Christ, massive amounts of commercialization? Yeah. All right. So in order to focus on Christ, we just dropped that one. We're going to begin a series this morning called Advent. We're going to be focusing on an Advent series, okay? And Advent simply means the coming or the arrival. Now, when we talk about the advent of the industrial age or the advent of the information age in our nation, we're simply talking about the time in history when those things arrived on the stage. And so when we talk about Advent during this Christmas season, we're speaking about the coming of Jesus Christ into this world. And historically, this time of year has been a time for followers of Jesus to reflect on the meaning of his coming into this world, into the earth. But before we get to that part of celebrating Advent and thinking about the meaning of it, reflecting on that stuff, we need to know something. And so I have a question for you this morning that may seem completely off the wall, but I'm going to connect the dots in just a little bit, okay? So here's the question. When someone, a friend or a family member or even a stranger, when someone offers you a piece of gum, do you accept it? No? Yes? Not chewed. No, a fresh piece of gum. All right? Not like they hand it out of their mouth. A fresh piece of gum, okay? Well, most people would say yes because, you know, you're thankful for the generosity of that other person, right? And you might think, you know, there must be a need for it. They're handing me a piece of gum, right? But I'm not much of a gum chewer myself. I enjoy it sometimes. It can be nice, but most of the time for me, like, the flavor goes away too quickly and I just get bored with it. So I'm not much of a gum chewer. And so before I accept an offer of a piece of gum, I have to know, is there a need? Is there a need? Like, I have to think through that. And of course, more often than not, I will accept because you got to err on the side of caution on these things, right? You can't just say, well, I don't think my breath stinks and just ignore it, right? And so unless I'm fairly certain that my breath doesn't smell like the rotting carcass of a squirrel who didn't quite make it across the road, or if I know I'm not going to be in close proximity to very many people and I don't think it stinks that bad, I will usually accept the piece of gum. But regardless of all of that, I do have to think through all that. My mind has to go through and make the assessment, is there a need? Do I need this piece of gum? Does my breath stink? And in the same way, before we can really reflect on the meaning of God becoming man and walking among us on this earth, before that meaning can be fully understood, we have to know, is it necessary? Was it necessary? Because if we were to try to contemplate the meaning of Christ's advent without knowing the need for his advent, I think we're probably likely not going to see it as a gift. We're not going to get it, so to speak. We're probably simply going to say, no thanks. Right? Now, if we don't see the need for Christ coming to earth, we might even resent people or at least dismiss them as a little bit too pushy, the people who try to explain that Christ did come and he came for you. Because we think, you know what, my breath smells just fine. I don't need him. We don't have the need. We don't understand it. And so on this first Sunday of Advent, that's what we're going to look into. Was there a genuine need for Jesus to come? By the way, idea how self-conscious I am of my breath all of a sudden at this moment after saying all that to you guys. I'm going to have a piece of gum here shortly, I think. Before, thank you, I appreciate it. I'll hit you up afterwards. Right now I've got a little space, so we're okay. But in order to answer the question, was there a need for Jesus to come, we have to start at the beginning. So let's start there. In Genesis chapter 1, starting in verse 26, it says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the heavens and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. So by God's own declaration, the whole earth, the human race, everything that he created was, quote, very good. It was very good. And in chapter 2, we see that perfect harmony in not only in his creation, but also even in human relationships. It goes on to say there in chapter 2, "And the rib that the Lord had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, 'This is at last bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh.' And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." It's beautiful, isn't it? It's perfect love, perfect relationship. But in chapter 4, something has changed a little bit. It goes on to say there, "In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him." It's different now, isn't it? There's a totally different mood in chapters 1 and 2 than there is here in chapter 4. I remember in chapter 1 when God looked at all he had made and he said it was very good? How could that be when you read that? Now check out the contrast as we move into chapter 6. "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart." Something had drastically changed, not only in the landscape of creation and the landscape that was given to mankind, but something has changed in mankind. He had become sinful. Now, if we could have stopped the story back at chapter 2, there would have been no need for what we know as Advent, for Jesus to come into this world. There would have been no need for it. But sin has forever changed that picture. We are sinful by nature. And maybe you've heard of the parable of the turtle and the scorpion. This is not a biblical parable. It's just a parable that's told. But the scorpion is, of course, a very poor swimmer. And so he asks the turtle to... I had a river going through there. I don't know what happened. Anyway... All right, so he asked the turtle to carry him on his back across the river. And the turtle says, "Are you crazy? I'm going to put you on my back and you're going to sting me and I'm going to drown." And the scorpion looked at the turtle and said, "Oh, don't be silly. You know, if I were to sting you while you were carrying me across the river, you would go down, but I would go down with you and drown as well. Why would I do that? There's no logic in that." And the turtle says, "Well, I guess you're right." And so reluctantly he said, "Hop on." And they started going across the river, and they no sooner got to the deep part of the water when the scorpion gave him a mighty sting right in his head. And the turtle began to sink to the bottom of the river, and he looked at the turtle looked at the scorpion and said, do you mind if I ask you something? Which, by the way, is an interesting way to start a conversation with your murderer while you're drowning. But anyway, he said, "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" He said, "You know, you told me there would be no logic in you stinging me when I carried you across the river. Why did you do it?" And the scorpion looked at the turtle and said, "Silly turtle, it has nothing to do with logic. It's just my nature. It's just my nature. You and I, we are all sinful. That is our nature. And if that's not true, tell me how babies demonstrate jealousy. How does that happen? Where do they learn that? Or where do we learn how to lie to our parents? Who teaches us that? No, we just start with it right in here, don't we? We have a sinful nature. If we were to sit down and think about our sin and the effect that it will have on our lives and the lives of those that we love and care about around us, we could very easily see how illogical sin is, right? How illogical it is to choose sin. And not only that, but we'd be able to stop sinning because we'd know, well, okay, that's not logical to do that, so I'm just going to do this instead. But how many of you can do that? How many of you can't seem to stop doing the thing that you know you need to stop doing or to start doing the thing that you know you need to start doing? But as the scorpion said, it doesn't have anything to do with logic, does it? It's not about logic and making a logical decision. It's simply our nature. That's who we are. Now, you won't hear that from secular sources, self-help books, the vast array of blogs that are out these days. Even many religious leaders won't say that. They would love to convince us, and even themselves, that people are basically good, you know, that there's just some bad actors among us. And they'll try to convince us, worse yet sometimes, that every impulse that we have is good and should be celebrated. That'd be even carrying it a little further. That, by the way, changes when you try to say that your impulse is to steal their watch. Suddenly that doesn't seem to be as good an idea anymore, but that's a whole other story. Now, modern psychology puts more importance today on the concept of the self-esteem than at any other time in all of history. In fact, no concept seems to be more important today than our personal identity, the way we see ourselves. Ironically and incidentally, this has only increased as we've had to rely on other people for our daily lives. But according to the credos that we've created in this self-identity, this age of identity, there are really just no bad people in the world, only people who think badly of themselves. Well, there's murderers and rapists and there's people who disagree with me. Those are bad people. But other than that, there's no bad people. Does that sound familiar? That's what we hear all the time these days. For years, education experts, psychologists, and a growing number of Christian leaders have determined and defended that self-esteem is a cure-all for all sorts of human miseries. The idea is that if people feel good enough about themselves, they will behave better. They're going to be less likely to commit crimes and whatever, and less likely to act immorally, whatever that means, if people are already good by nature. I don't understand how that works. But they'll do better in school, they'll enjoy life more, they'll have fewer problems with others. That's the idea. If you have more self-esteem, all these things will be true. Has that been true? Has it worked? Well, crime, even violent crime, is down over the last 20 years, so that's good. But also down is our academic achievement over the past 20 years. These are average SAT scores from 1967 to 2015. And not long ago, there was a standardized math test that was given to teenagers in 6 different nations. And the exam began with a simple question at the very beginning that everyone had to answer. It was a math exam, but it started with this question: I am good at mathematics. And they had to answer that to begin with it. And as you might have guessed, if you've been paying attention to the state of our education system these days, the American students didn't do so well in the math tests. In fact, we did the worst of these 6 nations that were tested, far behind the Korean students who held the top scores. Ironically, though, more than 75% of the Korean students said that they were not good at mathematics. And when you contrast that to the nearly the same number of American students, 68%, who said they were good at mathematics but didn't turn out that way. Interesting. Maybe this self-esteem focus isn't all it's cracked up to be. What about enjoyment of life? Now, surely we are happier as people these days, right? As a result of this focus on ourselves, we are a happier culture. Well, that's not what the evidence says either. The evidence says that the suicide rate in our nation is skyrocketing. It's increased 25% in the 5 years between 1999 and 2014, and it's continued to go up since 2016, excuse me. All this focus on self-esteem has not made us happier. It's not made us smarter. It's not made us better equipped socially or more moral. In fact, we might even be more tribal, certainly politically and maybe a lot of other ways too, than at any other point in our history. So let's take a look at what the Bible has to say about this notion that there are just no bad people, only people who think badly about themselves. And we could look at many places in Scripture for this today, but we're going to focus on one passage that I think answers the question most clearly. One of the doctrines that came out of the Reformation was the doctrine of total depravity. And that sounds kind of ominous, right? Total depravity. But, so we need to kind of be aware of what that means and what it doesn't mean, because a lot of people kind of misunderstand it. Total depravity does not mean that people are always as bad as they can be. That means I'm not always at my worst, right? It doesn't mean that sinful human nature is always expressed to the fullest. And it doesn't mean that people are incapable of being kind at some times or benevolent or having goodwill. And it doesn't mean that we can't appreciate things like beauty and honesty and decency and excellence. And it doesn't mean that we don't have access to or ability to act in righteous ways in some moments of time. What it does mean is that when sin entered the world, when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit that was forbidden to them, the nature of our humanity was totally changed. From that time on, sin contaminated every aspect of our humanity: our heart, our mind, our personality, our emotions, our motives, our conscience, our will. And because of that reality, we are incapable on our own in ability and desire to connect with holy God. That's what that means. The very thing we were created to do, connecting with holy God, we cannot do anymore. At the very core of our being, we have wrongness. And because of that wrongness inside of us, everything in our world is wrong. That's why God makes us new creations at salvation. And so contrary to what we're being taught these days, and truly what we want to believe in spite of the evidence, men and women and boys and girls, we are not morally good. We're not. We're not morally good. In fact, we are opposite of morally good. By nature, we are opposed to God. We are enslaved to our own sin, unable to believe even apart from the gracious intervention of God in our lives. And so the first step to a healthy and proper, according to the God who created us, a healthy and proper self-image, and hear me today, I'm not looking for us to have a bad self-image. I'm not saying that we should have a low self-esteem or think wrongly of ourselves, but we need to have a healthy and proper self-image. And the way to do that is to recognize that we are not inherently good. There's something gravely wrong, that we are not originally as we were created to be. And that's why Jesus commended the tax collector rather than rebuking him when he pounded his chest and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner." Right? That man had finally come to the point where he saw himself for what he was truly, who he truly was. And we might believe that that guy had low self-esteem and he needed to have that corrected. But in that moment, he saw himself more clearly and truly than he ever had before. Without the blinders of pride and pretense, he was able to see that there was nothing he could ever do to earn God's favor. And so he pleaded for God's mercy instead. Now that's the bad news, that our nature is not good. It's at odds with God. But the good news is that we're all in this together. No one is worse off or more valuable or less valuable than anyone else. And even better, we are loved still by God in spite of who we are. We are loved by God who has made a way for us to continue to have communion with him once again. So let's look into that passage I mentioned a moment ago. Grab your Bibles and turn to Romans chapter 3. We're going to take a look at what the Bible has to say about this idea that we are inherently good, that there's no bad people, just bad actors. Romans 3, 10 through 17. And it says, "As it is written, none is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. So Paul uses Old Testament scripture, actually, here in verses 10 through 17 to show us just how universal sin is. Six times in those verses, in those seven verses, he says something to the effect of no one, or not one, or none. And he shows, he does that to show just how far-reaching it is that sin is, right? He says, who escapes sin? No one, not one. Nobody has. And so there are three parts to his argument about how that works. And the first part is to show us how sin has corrupted us. That's number one. Sin has corrupted us. He says, as it is written, none is righteous, no one, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. In just those two short verses, Paul makes six charges against humanity. He says, because of our total depravity, people are universally evil. No one is righteous, he says. What he's saying there when he says none is righteous is that no one is right before God. No one is as God created them to be. Now, he's not arguing here that people are not able to do good things. He's not speaking of specific acts or even patterns of behavior. He's talking about our inner character, who we are before God. He's saying here that there is not a single human being who has ever lived or who is living or who will live whose innermost being could be labeled as righteous by God's standards. And of course, that standard is perfection, right? A holy, righteous God is perfect, and so his standard is perfection. And so what Paul is saying here is what many people often say, but they say it with less urgency. He's saying nobody's perfect, right? That's what he's saying. Now, when we say this, we're comparing ourselves to other people, usually, right? It's a way for us to boost our self-esteem, if we're being honest. When we say nobody's perfect, or when we say nobody's perfect to you, we're saying, I'm better than 95% of the people out there, right? I'm just not perfect. That's what we're saying. And that's okay. I mean, in some ways, it's okay. I mean, we should definitely not be trying to hold ourselves to a standard of perfection or try to attain perfection, because you're not going to be able to do it. Nobody is perfect, and you cannot be perfect. And besides that, that's not what gets us into heaven anyway. That's not how we're counted righteous by God. But we do need to know that that is God's standard, because he's perfect. We aren't perfect. He is, and so we need him. In his grade book, there is only pass and fail. There is no in between. If you don't fail as hard as somebody else, that makes no difference for eternity. You still have a failing grade, right? We might look good next to the not so morally great people in this world, but when we compare ourselves to the righteous perfection of holy God, we fail miserably. And not only are we universally evil, Paul also says that we are spiritually ignorant. No one understands. What he's talking about here is that our thought processes are so affected by our sin that there will always be some degree of deficiency in the way we understand the world around us, our grasp of the truth. And only as we know and understand God do we know and understand truth. What that means for us is that the way we understand the world is confused to the degree with which we navigate it without God, because all things have their meaning in God. In other words, if we're ignorant of God's truth, we will inevitably be ignorant of the important things, the truthful things of this world. Our worldview will place things that are not so important as super important. And it will place things that are really important as not really that big of a deal. And it'll be all kinds of deception and untruth entangled all throughout that. There are other descriptions, too, that Paul gives of humanity in our fallen state. He says that we're rebellious. We're wayward. We're spiritually useless. We're morally corrupt. No one does good, not one. The point that he's making is that sin has corrupted us. We are no longer what we're supposed to be. There's something that's not right between us and God. Chuck Colson made a statement a long time ago that I think could be said about pretty much anything going on in our political spectrum today. He said, the most astonishing thing about Whitewater, some of you guys remember Whitewater, right? You guys remember that? The most astonishing thing about Whitewater is that we were astonished by it. Our reaction, the press's feeding frenzy, and the politicians' posturing reveals how deluded we are about the most pernicious myth of this century, that man is good and that with technology and education, we can achieve utopian societies. So we regard Watergate and Whitewater and all gates in between as dreadful aberrations. Our founders were not so naive. They understood the Judeo-Christian truth that man is a sinner. We moderns have forgotten this foundational truth. The reason that we see the media circus these days, all the virtue signaling on Facebook, and these ever-growing but full of holes worldviews that try to account for reality but just fail miserably, is exactly that truth. People are not inherently good. People are inherently sinners. The reason that we have injustice in this world, the reason that even high-level leaders, politicians, pastors, CEOs, the reason they have moral failures is because we are sinners. We are not morally good, inherently good. The reason we have ridiculous choices for our elected positions is because people are not naturally good. That's why. That's our nature. Our character has been corrupted. It's a truth as old as time as we know it, but we choose to ignore that. But that's not the only thing that sin does to us. It corrupts our character, but it also, Paul says, it contaminates our conversations. Number two, he says, their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. It's true, isn't it? A person's character will inevitably manifest itself in our communication with others. Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. In other words, the way we speak, the way we choose to interact with the world around us, is an indicator of our inner character. And since we're not inherently good, but evil, we can't help but have our conversations and interactions with the world around us be contaminated with the ugliness of the sin that is within us. Notice just how comprehensively Paul says this contamination is. He compares the throat, the place where our speech first begins to be transformed from a rush of air into something that can be understood. He compares a throat to an open grave. That's pretty descriptive, isn't it? Then he moves on to where our speech is fine-tuned a little bit, our tongues, and says that they are caused by sin to be used in deception. Then to where our speech exits our bodies and receives any flourishes that are unique to us, or accents and that kind of thing. The lips, right? And he says, sin has filled our lips with snake venom. And finally, he says, the whole mouth is polluted. It's a powerful picture of what sin does to our communication with the world around us. And we're not able to control that, are we? At least not in our own power. We might be able to redirect it here and there when it seems beneficial to us, make a choice that is somewhat logical or seems logical to us when it's beneficial, but how many times have you opened your mouth and said something and you just couldn't believe you said that? Far too often for me. Or how many times have you said something, not even trying to do wrong, and you didn't realize the painful impact it would have on someone around you? Yeah, me too. That's not because we're innocent. That's not happening because it was just a bad circumstance like the world would have you believe. That stuff happens because we're blinded by sin and we can't see beyond our own little worlds. There's no doubt in my mind that without those blinders on, we would see much more clearly how our speech affects those around us. And if you don't believe me, how much better off is your speech when you just try to think of the people around you? It goes so much better when you just try to do it. So much. So sin corrupts our character, it contaminates conversations, and next Paul says that it alters our conduct. It alters our conduct. He says, their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, there's no doubt that we are a destructive people. Scottish theologian Robert Haldane in the 19th century wrote, "The most savage animals do not destroy so many of their own species to appease their hunger as man destroys of his own fellows to satiate his ambition, his revenge, or his greed." Quite an indictment. Speaking of greed, There was a national survey conducted where a scenario was presented that you could receive $10 million tax-free dollars, but to receive it, you had to choose one of the options that they gave you. And they were all pretty radical choices. And the responses were shocking, although as we're learning, they shouldn't be all that shocking. Two-thirds of people surveyed said they would actually be willing to choose one of these options. Here's the breakdown. 25% said that they would abandon their family for $10 million. 23% that they said that they would become a prostitute for a week. 16% said that they would give up their American citizenship. I don't know why that's less than the other one. 16% said that they would leave their spouse. 7% said they would commit murder. 4% said that they would mutilate their genitals. And 3% said that they would put their children up for adoption. For money. For money that is temporary. That only has value because we give it value. It's not like life. Money isn't like life, is it? It's not like friendship. It's not like family. It's not like a child. Look, if a lack of self-esteem were the issue, the problem of our human heart, why? Why would people choose money over people, over their own bodies? I mean, do those two-thirds of people who said they would take a choice there, do they just not have enough self-esteem? Is that the answer? I mean, if low self-esteem is our problem in our society, then why are society and death from drug overdoses skyrocketing? They're going huge. The reason is that self-esteem is not the problem. Self-esteem is not the solution to human depravity because we are not inherently good. At our core, we are evil. And we can't lull ourselves into thinking that just because we don't possess every single one of those characteristics that Paul mentions there in Romans 3, that we're just fine, that sin stuff is for other people. Because one is all it takes. And it doesn't even have to be a huge degree of that one. Remember, God's standard is perfection. It's not about how we measure up against other people. I like the picture that John MacArthur uses to illustrate this point. He compares our attempts to achieve God's righteousness in our current fallen state to a group of people trying to jump from the shore of a South Seas island to the United States. A great athlete, that's Tahiti right there, so it's an island in the South Seas. A great athlete could maybe jump 25 feet or more. A few people might be able to get 10 or 15 feet. You know, some people might be in such sorry shape they could maybe jump 1 or 2 or maybe 0 feet. And if you measure those against each other, there's those lines. They look considerably different. You can see the differences up there, right? You know, the athlete on the top and then kind of average people in the middle and then maybe a pretty good athlete in the bottom. But if you measure that distance from that island in the United States, the difference between each of those jumps would be undetectable and equally useless, right? Maybe Paul pictured something similar when he wrote just a few verses later in our chapter 3, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." Romans 3 paints a painful but clear and accurate picture of our condition. Our problem is not low self-esteem. Our problem is that we are sinful by nature, and that sin corrupts our character. It contaminates our conversation, and it alters our conduct. So what do you think? Does our breath stink? Is there a need? Is there a need for Jesus' coming to earth to live a perfect life and be the sinless, sacrificial lamb that covers our sin, that lifts us across that ocean where we can only jump a few feet? Yeah, absolutely, yes, there is a need. We all have that need. That is the greatest need that will ever be. And so we have a lot to celebrate and be thankful for this as we enter this season of Advent. I mean, maybe you're thinking, and as you're sitting there, you know, Nate, that wasn't a very celebratory message. That was kind of depressing, actually. Well, I'd be right with you if it wasn't for Advent. It would be depressing if we just stopped with our need. But Advent is here, right? And we can look forward to the fulfillment of that need. That's why we can celebrate, even though we fully understand our current fallen state of affairs, because you know what? Jesus did come. He did. He came to make a way to reunite us with God, to bring us across that ocean. If I can go back there. Where is it there? He made a way to bring us across that ocean. And as we move deeper into the Advent season, we're going to explore more of that in the messages to come. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we are so humbled that in our state of affairs, our fallen nature, Lord, that you would make that way, that you chose to still love us in spite of how we have rejected you, in spite of how we are at odds with you, that you crossed that ocean and are lifting us across it back to where we need to be. Father, help us to look to you, to turn to you in our time of need, and to make you what you need to be in each of our lives, to make you central, the thing that matters, that will put everything in our world right once again. Help us to look to you for that, Lord, and forgive us for the things that we have done to put us at odds with you. In Jesus' name.